Ben Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, what's in a word? Well, when the word is occupation, and it comes out of the mouth of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, it's a word very few, maybe even Mr. Sharon himself, ever expected to hear. Yesterday, the Prime Minister acknowledged for the first time publicly that Israel occupies land Palestinians claim, de-emphasizing his lifelong position that Jews had a biblical and security mandate to long-contested territory on the West Bank and in Gaza. To explore the importance of this new word in the Prime Minister's vocabulary, we're joined by Robert Pate of the London Times, who's in Jerusalem. Welcome, Robert.
Hello, thank you.
Robert, thanks. Well, what Sharon said was to keep 3.5 million people under occupation is bad for us and them. That's all he said. Important or, after all, just a word?
Well, I think it's important. Essentially, he's using the same vocabulary that is adopted habitually by not only the Palestinians, but also those in the left of the Israeli political spectrum and Israel's critics abroad. So what Mr. Sharon appears to be doing is preparing the ground in Israel for an historical political compromise, which hitherto he has been prepared to not been prepared to countenance.
So this is not just a temporary bone thrown to a U.S. administration interested in showing some progress?
With Mr. Sharon, it's always very hard to define his intentions. And he has been observed today by several observers of the scene in Israel that he's a man of zigzags. He's been known in the past to say things which seem to represent a major seismic political shift in his vocabulary and then step back from them. For example, he said a month and a half ago that he was prepared to contemplate the evacuation of religiously important settlements in the occupied territories, which would be agonizing for him. And then, you know, 2 weeks ago, he appeared to somewhat step back from that and say that Jews would always live in these places. Today, he once again has repeated that pattern. He has suggested that what he really meant to say yesterday was not occupation, but that he did not want to rule over the Palestinian lands, the Palestinian populations, and in areas which were, and I quote here, in dispute. But I think, really, the cat is out of the bag. You know, the genie is now out, and the damage, if one wants to put it that way, has probably been done.
Well, there was a summit slated for tomorrow between Prime Minister Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. That's been postponed. Mahmoud Abbas pulled back from it. What can you tell us about that and why the postponement?
It's been postponed basically because of the intervention of Yasser Arafat. Mr. Arafat, as your listeners will be aware, has been on the receiving end of a concerted attempt by the United States and Israel to sideline him on the basis that they allege that he has been involved with or fomented terrorism and been the moving force behind the Palestinian Intifada. Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas, basically was appointed at Mr. Arafat's behest. But Mr. Arafat does not want to give up the reins of power. He very much wants to pull the strings behind the scenes. And he certainly does not want Mr. Abbas to be making any compromises in negotiations with the Israelis, which he is not given a session to first. And basically, he wants to hold a veto power over Mr. Abbas.
Yasser Arafat still pulling strings in what is still very much a zigzagging peace process. Robert Pate of the London Times, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, as Ariel Sharon and his government try to navigate the Mideast roadmap, an American group called the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace says they have a blueprint to build at least one bridge. On May 7th, the Chicago-based organization launched a campaign to provide money to pay settlers to leave the West Bank and relocate to Israel proper. The group says it's guided by the tenets of Jewish law, and joining us to discuss the effort is Marcia Friedman. She's president of the Jewish Alliance for Peace and Justice. Welcome, Marcia.
Thank you.
Well, right off the bat, there are people who are going to disagree with your premise that money will move settlers. They will say that the settlement movement is a defensive one to protect Israel, or that settlements are a God-given right, part of an ideology.
Yes, there are people who will say that, but there's research that says that most of the settlers don't believe any of those things. This is research that was conducted for the organization Peace Now in Israel, and it's a survey that shows that 80% of the settlers say very clearly that they would obey a lawful order to evacuate settlements at any time, and 60% of all of the settlers say that they would accept a compensation for their homes in order to return to Israel proper, and they would do so immediately. And so we are addressing our campaign to those 60 or 80% of the settlers who are non-ideological. They are in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in order to improve the quality of their life, responding to the offer by the Israeli government over the past 20 years of major incentives, economic incentives, to relocate to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Well, Marcia, putting aside how many there may be of these settlers, how would you do it?
We're calling on our government to urge Israel to cease the economic incentives to bring new settlers to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and to use these funds instead to establish a fund to provide housing grants to settlers who would like to relocate back into Israel proper. Barring that, if the Israeli government does not wish to cooperate, we're calling on the United States to spearhead the establishment of an international fund. Our estimate is that the whole effort would cost some $2 to $3 billion, which in international terms is not a lot of money. It's less than the United States gives to Israel in foreign aid in 1 year.
Well, and the incentives on the other side that you're talking about from the Israeli government, we have heard them reported tax breaks, low-interest mortgages?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
And what are some of the other incentives that you feel the Israeli government offers to people to get them to move to settlements?
The per capita expenditure by the government for settlers is twice as high as that of Israelis in Israel proper, which means that there is an enormous amount of investment in infrastructure, in community building, and in community institutions. This does not take into account at all the cost of their defense.
Well, Marcia, what about the Palestinian side? There are Israeli and American Jews who might agree with you, but say steps that you're suggesting shouldn't be taken until the violence stops and the new PLO leadership shows that it's willing to go, for instance, after Hamas.
I think it's very, very important that the violence stops. I think it's very important that the PLO leadership go after Hamas and do all that is possible to stop the violence. On the other hand, I don't think that any of us, not the Palestinians, not the Israelis, not the Americans, not the Europeans, should be held hostage to some small number of suicide bombers who are supporting Hamas and who do not wish to see a peaceful resolution to this crisis and do not wish to see a compromise.
Mm. Well, Marcia, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Marcia Friedman is president of the Chicago-based Jewish Alliance for Peace and Justice. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
The government of Canada today unveiled new legislation that will decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana, while increasing penalties for large growing operations. The controversial bill is opposed even by some members of the Prime Minister's governing Liberal Party, and opposed very much by the Bush administration. Dan Gardner is a staff writer with the Ottawa Citizen newspaper. He's written extensively about international drug policy, and he joins us now on the line from Ottawa. Hi, Dan.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Thanks, Dan. Tell us briefly, how will the new legislation change Canada's marijuana laws?
Well, not enormously. I mean, this is being billed as a great liberalization, or it has been talked about as that in the past, but it's actually not that. I mean, in 1968, this would have been a bold change, but it's not today. In effect, what it will say is that if you possess less than 15 grams of marijuana, you will be handed a $150 ticket. That essentially, that that portion of the law is almost identical to the law as it now exists in 12 American states that have decriminalized. And in fact, those changes occurred 20, 25 years ago. So that tells you that this is not that bold a change. In addition to that, the government has dramatically increased, I think, punishments on marijuana growing operations, so that large growing operations, instead of having a maximum of 7-year sentence, will now have a maximum of 14 years. And one of the themes that the government emphasized and the ministers emphasized in the press conference over and over again is that we want tougher punishments, tougher punishments. And I think it would be a mistake to see this necessarily as some sort of grand liberalization for that reason.
Canada's law is still much tougher than many laws in Europe, for example. Dan, tell me, the Bush administration is very, very upset about this policy. Drug czar John Walters, in particular, has been very critical of the policy. They're particularly concerned that Canadian marijuana could flood the U.S. market. A reasonable concern?
Well, answer this question. Is Minnesota marijuana flooding Manitoba? Is Maine marijuana flooding New Brunswick? Or is New York State marijuana flooding Ontario? Hmm. The answer is no in every case, and yet each one of those states decriminalized marijuana possession years ago. So I frankly don't think that any serious policy analysts genuinely believe that the decriminalization of small amounts of marijuana would in any way increase cultivation or trafficking.
Well, your marijuana up there is allegedly also extremely potent. John Walters of the drug czar in the United States, John Walters, has called it the crack cocaine of marijuana. What about that?
Well, first of all, if you speak to a pharmacologist and you said the crack cocaine of marijuana, they would say that's gibberish. It makes no sense. They're two unrelated drugs.
Yeah.
Secondly, the notion that Canadian marijuana has soared in potency and is uniquely potent and is therefore uniquely dangerous is absolute nonsense. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which is our federal police force, issued a document in which they stated categorically that there's been a great deal of exaggeration about marijuana potency in Canada, and they laid out their analyses. And their analyses show that the average marijuana in Canada is about 6%, which is about 1% higher than it is in the United States. Big deal. And more fundamentally, what the mistake that the drug czar is making is that he assumes that more potent marijuana equals more dangerous marijuana. There's simply no evidence of that, for the simple reason that users of more potent marijuana will, in fact, inhale less smoke. In the same way that when someone's drinking a beer, they will drink more volume of liquid than they would if they were sipping vodka. Users of more potent marijuana simply reduce their use. It's just common sense.
Well, Dan, tell me, in the Canadian parliamentary system, now that we've had our conversation, is it certain that this decriminalization of marijuana, tell me briefly, will it certainly become law, or could it possibly still not become law?
There's a wrinkle. It's almost certain, but there's a wrinkle. It's almost certain for the reason that we have what has been sometimes been described as a benign dictatorship. The Liberal Party, that's capital L, Liberal Party, has been in power for 10 years and looks to be in power for the next century. And if the Prime Minister leading the Liberal Party decides that he wants it, he will have it. However, the Prime Minister has announced his retirement coming...
Briefly, Dan, if you could.
Sure. He's announced his retirement, and the likely candidate to take over from him has expressed more of a law and order attitude, so it's not entirely certain.
Dan Gardner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dan Gardner, staff writer with the Ottawa Citizen in Canada.
Just ahead, we stay up north, another outbreak of SARS in Toronto. More coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Capital Steps, performing their newest political musical satire at the Copley Theater, June 17th through the 22nd. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster and Bostix. And the Eliason Group, providing clients with technology specialists on a contract or permanent basis on the web at eliassen.com. This is WBUR.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli.
The admission of 8 former communist countries is a very powerful symbol of Europe's reunification. So the EU is going to need some very serious internal reform, and everybody agrees that's not going to be very easy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Don't miss a chance to meet the incomparable Sylvia Poggioli at an exclusive brunch I'll be hosting on Sunday, June 1st. Seating is limited. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 1-800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
8 new probable and 26 suspected cases of SARS have put Toronto back on the World Health Organization's list of affected areas. The new cases appear to be centered around healthcare workers, and some are saying that though precautions were initially taken, Toronto citizens may have dropped their guard and their face masks too soon. Joining us on the line from Toronto, Canada, is David Seglins, a reporter with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Dave, what do these latest cases tell us about SARS? In other words, how do people think this happened?
They found a few clusters in one rehab hospital, and then they traced it back through a bunch of transfers between hospitals. They think it was a 96-year-old man somewhere in mid-April came down with SARS. They've got two theories. One, there was a case of SARS within the hospital that got passed between patients and simply went undetected, so it tells us a little bit that SARS is still very difficult to detect in some patients. The other theory that's going around is not that citizens are necessarily dropping their guard, but maybe that doctors and nurses, figuring that SARS had been defeated in Toronto, they let their guard down, took the masks off, and somehow they may have transferred it within a hospital setting, giving it to this first guy who then passed it on to a whole series of others.
Right. And so what has happened? We hear about a quarantine?
Well, as a precaution, in any area affected, anyone who's had potential exposure to any of the people who are now under investigation, they go into a 10-day quarantine, or they're asked to go into a 10-day quarantine. Right now, that's affecting about 2,000 people here in Toronto.
Meaning what? They have to stay at home or stay in the hospital where they were when the outbreak was announced? How does it work?
All it is avoid family and friends, you know, keep your distance or wear a mask when you're at home. Many of the people hit are healthcare workers. They're essential workers. Many are paramedics. So some of those people, even though as just a precaution they're to be in some sort of isolation, they still can go to work. It's called a working quarantine where they just wear a gown and they wear a mask. They're asking those people not to ride public transit, not wanting to fuel public alarm because this still is contained within hospitals.
We should say Toronto has not been put under a travel advisory by the WHO because, as you say, the cases seem to be centered around hospitals. But last time the travel advisory was imposed, even for a few days, it, you know, deeply affected Toronto. How are people responding to this latest news?
Well, our city officials would be happy to know that you're making that distinction because in Toronto we get it. There's not a lot of alarm here, but they're concerned that people are going to hear Toronto, reemergence of SARS, and not visit. And they've calculated that we've already lost $1 billion in visits and tourism from the first wave. With this new one, even though there's no travel advisory, People's Association, Toronto and SARS, they're estimating it's going to cost us hundreds of millions of dollars in new losses. And so they're really trying to get the message out to people in the international media and international travelers that Toronto remains a safe place to visit. There is not heightened alarm. This is still contained within hospitals.
Well, Dave, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dave Seglins is a reporter with the CBC. He spoke to us from Toronto, Canada.
Staying in Canada, Robin, the search continues today for the origin of the mad cow disease that was identified in one cow in the Canadian province of Alberta last week. But the U.S. border remains closed to Canadian beef. Canadian officials admitted yesterday that the puzzle over that one cow may never be solved. Mad cow disease, or BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, as it's officially called, most often develops when a cow is given a protein supplement made from other cows. That practice was banned in Canada 6 years ago. So what are the possible causes now? Joyce Van Dunkersgood is the veterinarian for the Alberta Cattle Feeders Association. Dr. Van Dunkersgood, hello.
Welcome.
Thanks for joining us. One cow in Canada had mad cow disease. That's had enormous repercussions, as we know. A lot of animals have now been slaughtered. More are in quarantine. Give us first briefly an update on how the investigation stands at this point.
My understanding is that the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, along with USDA experts, continue to trace back to investigate the origins of that one cow. They right now have 17 herds under quarantine and are currently testing the second trace back.
What do you think caused the disease?
Well, that's the big question that everyone would like an answer to. Right now, there appear to be two possibilities. One is a spontaneous gene mutation. The second is that the cow somehow got some prohibited material in its feed.
Well, let's take them both then. How would a cow get some prohibited feed?
Well, we've had a ban in Canada since 1997 against feeding ruminant protein back to ruminants.
Ruminants meaning cows and sheep.
And goats and bison and elk and deer, yes. So bone and meat meal is prohibited material and is not allowed to be fed back to cattle or other ruminants. And so this cow, they say, might be 8 years of age. So it may be older than when the ban came in place. So there is the potential that it was maybe exposed before we had the feed ban.
Now, you also mentioned the possibility of something happening spontaneously. Now, that would make one nervous. Could that happen again?
Well, I guess it's a theory right now. Scientists don't really understand that. It happens in human cases of CJD and...
CJD?
Yeah, Khrushchev-Jakob disease in humans.
Which is the disease that humans get, which is passed through this mad cow disease.
Yes, there are two different forms, the regular CJD and then the variant form, which happens in younger children. And that is the form that has been associated potentially with consuming mainly nervous tissue from ruminants that may have got into the food supply.
So small as the risk may be with just one cow out of so many with mad cow disease, it could also be that the borders will eventually reopen, but without any guarantee that this couldn't happen again.
There's no such thing as zero risk. This can happen anywhere.
Now, Doctor, strictly forbidden in Canada, as elsewhere now, to feed cows to other cows through feed. But cattle are still being given protein supplements derived from other animals. Couldn't that be a problem as well?
That has never been shown to be a source of transmission of BSE. Right now, the only source has been identified, mainly with research done in the UK, is feeding infected ruminant protein back to ruminants. We have not seen cross-species transfer on that.
Dr. Joyce Van Dunkersgood, thank you very much for joining Here and Now.
You're welcome.
Joyce Van Dunkersgood is a veterinarian for the Alberta Cattle Feeders Association in Canada.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, in college and just old enough to vote, university students may be next year's politically important soccer moms.
And chef Kathy Gunst prepares for summer with a recipe for fish kebabs. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Bildner Charitable Public Health Trust, supporting coverage of disease prevention and control. Restaurant Clio at the Elliott Hotel, named one of America's 50 best hotel restaurants by Food and Wine Magazine 2003. Reservations at ElliottHotel.com. And Boston Botanicals, offering comprehensive interior plant service and design to businesses in Greater Boston and proprietors of a unique flower shop in downtown Boston. You can meet Here and Now host Bill Delaney and learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour of Ireland tonight at a free reception. In order to reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. 800-909-9287. 57 degrees right now in Boston. This is WBUR. Michael Goldstein talks about why he chose WBUR when considering which institutions to support with a major gift.
I decided to make a major gift to BUR because, quite frankly, I can't imagine living in Boston without WBUR in my life. And just that thought alone pushed me to making a major contribution.
To become a member of WBUR's leadership circle, call 617-353-1151.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, American students take over a tough love school in Costa Rica. But we'll hear from the mother of one girl who says the school is just what her daughter needed.
Also, filmmakers D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hedges take us on a magical musical tour of Stax Records, Memphis's answer to Motown.
People as diverse as Janis Joplin and the Stones wanted to go down and record to get the kind of sound that was coming out of there with Otis Redding and William Bell and Wilson Pickett recorded there. I mean, a whole assortment of soul stars, many of which we have in the film.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. More deadly violence involving American troops in Iraq. Two U.S. soldiers and two unidentified attackers were killed today in a firefight in the town of Fallujah. Yesterday, one soldier was killed and another wounded when an Army convoy was attacked. U.S. Army spokesman Captain David Connolly says the attacks show Iraq remains a dangerous place.
Over the last 24 hours, we've had several incidents in which service members lost their lives. Our hearts go out to the families, friends, and fellow service members who may have lost a loved one. These incidents serve as a reminder that we will face many more challenges and dangers throughout Iraq. However, we remain committed to our original objectives.
Two other Americans died today in accidents in Iraq. President Bush is set to sign a $15 billion authorization to fight AIDS, which the government claims will prevent 7 million new cases of the disease. The five-year plan centers on preventing and fighting AIDS in Africa and the Caribbean. Critics worry that a federal ban on money for health clinics that provide abortions could severely hamper the new initiative. Two pro-democracy activists, including one from the U.S., are being detained in China for plotting terrorist attacks. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the pair, American Benjamin Lan and Sun Gang of New Zealand, are being investigated for violating Chinese laws. But a spokesman for the California-based China Federation Foundation says the two were in China to promote democracy and investigate the outbreak of SARS. A retired Roman Catholic priest was sentenced to 20 years in prison in Louisville, Kentucky today after pleading guilty to multiple counts of sexual abuse. Reverend Lewis Miller is the first of four priests who face criminal charges in Kentucky. The Supreme Court has upheld the right of state workers to take time off to take care of children or relatives. The decision affirms the Family and Medical Leave Act, a 1993 federal law, which grants 12 weeks unpaid leave for family emergencies. The court says workers have the right to sue in federal court to ensure their time off. The U.S. dollar continues its fall on the global foreign exchange as it hit an all-time low against the euro today. The U.S. dollar is now worth about 84 euro cents. And on Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 127 points at 87.28, the Nasdaq up 36 at 15.46. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the law firm of Davis, Malman, D'Augustine, P.C., knowing the lay of the land, not just the law, on the web at davismalm.com. That's D-A-V-I-S-M-A-L-M. By Flora Restaurant on Mass Ave in Arlington, featuring a new private dining room for business or pleasure, seasonal menus created by Chef Bob Sargent on the web at florarestaurant.com. And the Huntington Theater Company, presenting Springtime for Henry, a classic comedy, playing now through June 15th, huntingtontheater.org. In the forecast, the cloudy, cool spell continues with a high today expected of about 62. Tonight, cloudy near 50. Tomorrow, cloudy, a bit warmer, but a better chance of rain with highs around 65. 58 degrees right now in Boston. And in sports, the Red Sox will be playing Game 2 of their series against the Yankees in New York tonight. Bruce Chen on the mound for the Sox.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
American students at a tough love school in Costa Rica in the past week twice rose up, tore up textbooks and classrooms, and at least for a while, took over. The rebellion at the Dundee Ranch Academy ignited after Costa Rican police and government officials visited to investigate allegations of child abuse. The school's part of a network that emphasizes discipline to confront the problems of troubled teenagers. Brian Harris is a reporter for the Tico Times, an English-language Costa Rican paper. He joins us now from the capital, San Jose.
Good to be here, Bill.
Well, Brian, thank you for joining us. Tell me about the uprising. Can you describe what you know?
Yeah, apparently when authorities told the students that the school rules, including the rigid discipline that school authorities imposed on them, didn't apply under Costa Rican law, the students took it to mean that no rules applied under Costa Rican law, and many of them chose to run ramshot over the campus, destroying and vandalizing some of the property there. Others chose to just leave, although they found that the isolated campus located about a 4 or 5 kilometer walk from the nearest town didn't offer them much as far as an escape route.
Oh, some did escape, though.
Well, some left, and a few, we believe six, managed to make it to offices of the Child Welfare Office, or PANI, as it's known in Spanish here. But most of the students sort of wandered around until the heat and the dust got to them, and then sort of began to filter back onto the campus where they had the security of a bed and a hot meal.
Huh. How many students there altogether?
Enrollment has fluctuated, but it's believed to be between about 180 and 200 students.
So who is in charge, Brian, and what's become of the people who were in charge amid these allegations of child abuse?
Well, the owner of the facility, Narvin Litchfield of Utah, was briefly detained by police Thursday night. He was released later on Friday, although his release is conditional and he must check in with police every 2 weeks.
How did the allegations surface? How did authorities learn about it?
Well, some from reports in our newspaper, but also a former director sent a rather scathing letter to local authorities denouncing conditions at the school.
Corporal and punishment, you say?
Yes, corporal punishment. Not necessarily in the terms of actual beatings, although some students did complain of that, but as far as physical punishment, forcing students to stand in a corner silently without moving for hours at a time, forced marches as a form of punishment for supposed violations of the rules, those types of incidents.
Brian, you visited the school several times. What was your sense of the place and of the people who ran it and the kids who were there?
Well, of the kids, certainly these were kids who were having their spirits broken to be built back up. That was definitely the philosophy. You would pass them in the hallway, and they would step aside and say, "Excuse me, sir," in unison. Boys and girls, although they passed each other regularly in the hallways, were not allowed to talk to each other, those sorts of things. As far as the staff, most of the staff were convinced that what they were doing was right for these kids.
Did the place give you the creeps? As you say, there are people who are, including parents of some of these kids, who are advocates of the place.
Yeah, parents are. Most parents are actually very supportive of the place and think that it's doing wonders for their children. My feeling was that these teens were, in a sense, being sent to this school because the parents didn't really want to deal with the problems at home. And so I got a sense from many of the kids that they were feeling very lonely.
Huh. Brian, what happens next, as far as you know? We don't know yet whether anybody will actually go to jail over all this.
No, we don't. And there's another similar facility from a different company that also operates here in Costa Rica. And so far, authorities have made no investigation of that facility, insofar as we can tell.
Oh, so there might be another similar case to come?
Perhaps. Again, it's a different company and in all likelihood, a different philosophy towards the treatment of the children that may be more in sync with the laws of Costa Rica.
Hmm. I imagine the school's in a very beautiful place.
It's in a very beautiful yet isolated place down a dirt road. Again, the nearest town of any importance is about 4 or 5 kilometers away. The nearest town regional center is about 20 kilometers away. It's very isolated, and it is a nice setting, but it's also a very lonely setting.
Mm. Brian Harris, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Brian Harris is a reporter for the Tico Times. He joined us from San Jose, Costa Rica. We turn now to Mindy Slavis, who's the mother of Alexandra Slavis, who was a student at the Dundee Ranch Academy in Costa Rica. Ms. Slavis, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi.
What did she tell you about what happened at the Dundee Ranch Academy in the past week or so?
Well, we didn't talk for long because all she was doing was crying that she wanted to go back to Dundee Ranch, and I told her that wasn't possible, that the school was closing. She said she loved it there, that they were really doing her a lot of good, and she was hoping that they reopened so she could be transported back there.
Now, of course, we just learned in our previous segment that students at Dundee Ranch Academy were transferred from there over to Jamaica. Your daughter was one of those. She liked Dundee Ranch Academy. In our conversation with Brian Harris, a reporter for a newspaper down there, he said on his visits to the academy, he'd seen a lot of very lonely teenagers, he said. Your daughter's reaction was different to the place.
Yes, I have letters telling me it was the best gift, and she only thanked her father and I because she said she would have been leading a life of crime.
Well, tell us why you sent your daughter there in the first place.
She was a very good girl up until the age of 15. She became hostile and angry and was skipping school, and she had always been an honor roll student like the rest of my children. She's gone to private school her entire life, And then all of a sudden she wasn't going, so I wasn't going to pay the high cost of private school. So I put her in the public high school for a year. That didn't work either, so then we sent her to Costa Rica after she stole her father's credit card and went on a buying spree with $2,500.
My. What do you think was in the program at Dundee Ranch Academy that helped turn her around?
Well, they did have to restrain her when she first got there, because when she was told she'd be staying a long time, around a year, she punched the owner's wife. So they restrained her. Two times she was restrained, she wrote in her letters. And then she told me she didn't want to be restrained anymore for bad behavior. So she decided that she would be good and take part in the program. And she writes about the classes that she took, marriage and the family, an elective she chose. And all her letters are very positive.
Weren't you concerned that it could go the other way, that when children are put in such isolation and possibly even abused, as some allegedly were at this ranch academy, that that could cause more damage than anything else?
Well, that was a thought in my mind before I placed her, but I was at a point that I didn't know what else to do, and I thought I'd give it a try, and she ended up really liking it there.
Now, she's in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. How long will she stay there? When will she come home? She's been through a pretty traumatic experience.
Well, she hit level 3 on her third month.
What does that mean?
It's 6 levels in the program in order to graduate.
I see.
She made level 3, and we want her to graduate.
Will she receive a high school diploma when this is finished?
Yes, she will, and she'll go right on to college.
Mindy Slavis, we want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Mindy Slavis is the mother of Alexandra Slavis, who was a student at the Dundee Ranch Academy in Costa Rica.
Still to come, the hair on your arm raising sounds of soul in the film Only the Strong Survive.
You're listening to Here and Now.
There are several things that disqualify potential blood donors. Just got tattooed or returned from a country where malaria is prevalent? Wait a year. And if you're a gay man who's had sex with another man since 1977, don't show up at all, according to Food and Drug Administration guidelines. The national policy prompted students at Southern Oregon University to call off this year's semester's annual blood drive in protest. Joining us on the line is SOU senior Daniel Connor. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
First of all, what are your concerns about the policies?
Well, my concerns about the policies is that it is a discriminating viewpoint that only sees HIV and AIDS as a gay problem and has that history since 1980.
Some would say, and in fact the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say, that men who have sex with men represent the largest proportion of new HIV infections. That's 42%. So isn't it better to err on the side of perhaps offending some?
Well, actually, the statistics do show that there's been a decline since 1992 of about 50% in AIDS diagnosis, in new AIDS cases, among men who have had sex with other men.
Yeah, but still, I mean, some would say it kind of makes sense, you know, to err on the side of safety.
Well, the fact is that all of those behaviors that the FDA recommends are risky behaviors, if they are treated within blood screening programs, they have a trial period at which, if they don't engage in that risky activity, they can go ahead and give blood after that point. But with gay men, it's if you've ever had sex, or any man who's had sex with another man, in the last 26 years, regardless of whether or not now, after 26 years, you don't test positive, you cannot give blood ever. You know, the blood banks all have to test every sample of blood. In fact, when you give blood, I've been told, because I'm not allowed, when you give blood, you actually give a little extra so that they can sample your blood to make sure that you're not infected with any of these infectious diseases that they test for.
As I read, you are particularly concerned with this because you are a gay man. Tell me how you see this on a personal level.
I honestly don't see this as a gay issue, because it's not just gay men who have sex with other men. And also the risky behavior that men are partaking in, which is, of course, anal intercourse. Also, men have anal sex with women.
As you point out, women could have had sex with an infected man and not know it.
That's correct. And if they have had sex with a man who's had sex with another man, they are allowed to give blood after a 1-year period, unlike men. 26-year period.
Well, Daniel, you were quoted in a news article as saying, "I'm a gay man and I don't like being forced to lie to help people."
That might not be the best way to put it. Actually, requested to lie to help people is the proper way of saying it. People say, "Well, why don't you just not tell them that you've had sex with other men?" But that's committing perjury.
Let's be clear. It's said to take 6 months for the AIDS antibodies to show up in a test.
That's correct. Not 26 years.
Would you rather that nobody could give blood if they haven't been tested in the last 6 months for AIDS?
It's very difficult to verify the fact that someone has been tested recently. So what I would recommend, actually, is just a reevaluation of the time policies on these problems. It takes 6 months to be tested for it. Why not a year since you've had sexual contact?
Well, Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Daniel Connor is a senior at Southern Oregon University.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Peace Corps, from Cape Cod to Cape Town, Boston to Bulgaria, promoting friendship through service. Information meetings all across New England, 617-565-5555. Also by Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroqh.com. You can meet Silvia Poggioli this Sunday and ask her your questions while enjoying a delicious brunch hosted by On Point's Tom Ashbrook. Seating is limited. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 800-909-9287. 58 degrees right now in Boston. Still to come on Here and Now, a look at a new documentary about Motown, and then the BBC coming up at 1 o'clock.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There are two new memorials to the legendary and long-departed Stax Music label of Memphis, Tennessee. One is a new museum dedicated to the studio that produced Sam and Dave and Otis Redding. The other is a documentary by D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus, the same filmmakers who chronicled the Clinton campaign in The War Room and Bob Dylan in Don't Look Back. In Only the Strong Survive, they tell the stories of musicians who not only survived the 60s and 70s Memphis soul scene, but still give goosebump-inducing performances, like this one from Sam Moore of Sam and Dave.
You ready?
Only the Strong Survive directors D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus join us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City to talk about their new documentary. Thank you both for being here.
Happy to be here.
Me too.
And I'm going to call you Penny. Is that okay?
Fine.
I have to say, when the film began, I thought, well, all right, this is going to be interesting. And then, wham, there's a performance. And for the first of several times, I could not breathe. Was it like that for you?
Well, they were all kind of, you know, we were ready to go on forever and follow Roger. He's ready to make this film the rest of his life, I think.
Right, we should say the film is narrated by producer Roger Friedman, who takes us on this journey, and there's a Greek chorus of Rufus Thomas of 1963's Walking the Dog fame, and he's now DJing a morning show in Memphis with J. Michael Davis.
Walking the dog. Walking the dog. Don't know how to do it. Show you how to walk the dog.
Rufus really was a national treasure. Sadly, he died about a year after we shot the film. Rufus called himself the world's oldest teenager, and that really sums it up. He was 82 years old when we filmed him. Rufus started in minstrel shows, had the first hit, I think, on Sun Record, and then Elvis came along, so his career there didn't continue, but he was the first artist actually on the Stax record label, which was really the heart and soul, I think, of soul music.
Right. Penny, tell me more about Stax Records in Memphis.
Well, it was like some nirvana for me, because the first time I'd ever heard that music was Dylan took me to the Go-Go in Los Angeles to hear Otis.
Is that Bob Dylan?
Bob Dylan,
okay.
Yeah. And the every aspect of it was just, it your back turned into soup, you know.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. And I always wanted to see what that came from, where he came from. So when we got to Memphis, there was nothing left but a vacant lot, actually, because they'd torn the studio down.
People as diverse as Janis Joplin and the Stones wanted to go down and record to get the kind of sound that was coming out of there with Otis Redding and William Bell and Wilson Pickett recorded there. I mean, a whole assortment of soul stars, many of which we have in the film.
Let's talk about some of them. Sam Moore of Sam and Dave fame, he's now traveling with his wife. And he would seem to be the story that people are familiar with, the superstar who was down on his luck and now has something of a comeback. He
yeah.
almost lost it all.
Well, I think that he and Sam and Dave were, of course, an unbelievable team. And because they not only sang, they danced and carried on. They were just all over the world. People knew Sam and Dave. And then they split up. And Sam actually made a record. And then somehow he got lost. Nobody's sure how, and disappeared. And in the course of it, he kind of went downhill and got into selling drugs and all sorts of terrible things. And luckily, Joyce, his present wife, came along and kind of pulled him out of the swamp and saved him.
Yeah. In the film, he's driving along and he talks about places where he used to sell drugs and sold the rights to his music for drugs. But one of those hair-on-your-arm-raising moments in the movie comes when he steps to the mic at a concert organized by Isaac Hayes and sings "When Something Is Wrong With My Baby."
When something is wrong with my baby, can you hear me? Something is wrong with me. Listen.
None of the subjects seem at all affected either by their former fame, their current fans, or the fact that there's cameras pointed at them.
Well, you know, all of the people that we ran into in this genre, the thing that really struck me was, unlike jazz, where every man for himself or every woman for herself, they all seem held together like a family. And I think it's because that music comes out of
gospel.
And in gospel, and in many of the audiences we've had for the film since we've been showing it, talk right back to it, you know? And it's such a kind of wonderful communal experience that you realize when you run the film that you're not, it isn't a thing they just experience. They really live it.
Right. Even if it's not alive in other ways anymore, I'm thinking of Carla Thomas, who's one of the artists that, I mean, she just jumped off the screen for me, and yet I don't think she's recorded or traveled since her huge hit, Gee Whiz. But just as her father, who we spoke of, Rufus Thomas, might have been maybe pushed aside by Elvis, she, some would say, was pushed aside by Aretha. But when you hear her sing, you know what we've missed. Let's listen to Gee Whiz.
Wonderful.
Carla Thomas singing Gee Whiz. Wilson Pickett, unlike some of the others in the film, still seems to be real full of Wilson Pickett-ness.
Right.
and all power to him. But he of all of them, he seems to have the most showmanship. Is that the right word?
He's like a handful of tacks. I'll tell you. You really have to watch out for him.
I mean, he was incredible to be around. He still puts on an amazing performance. And, you know, he still gets pretty big audiences, and we were lucky to hook up with him right when he was putting out, you know, his first CD in I think 10 years. So I don't know, it was really alive and fun, and he's, you know, he's somewhat dangerous, so you never know what's going to happen around him. So he's a great film subject.
I remember 19-
Isaac Hayes, did you ever see him without his sunglasses?
Briefly, but not a lot. He really hides under those glasses. I mean, we all knew Shaft, so it's not a surprise when we heard him sing it. But when he sang that last song that we used, "Don't Let It Go," that just killed me. I just love that song,
yeah.
And I never heard it before.
Hear the whistle, it's 10 o'clock.
Don't let it go. Don't let it go.
Come on, baby, it's time to rock.
Don't let it go. Don't let it go.
I'm so glad I got you here.
Don't let it go. Don't let it go.
Keeps me grinning from ear to ear.
Don't let it go. Don't let it go.
Chris and Penny, did you both handle the cameras in this? Were you the filmmakers?
Yeah.
Well, we all do everything. We're kind of a family's operation, so and we use our children whenever we can because it saves money.
We both filmed this. Actually, it was our very first effort leaving film and going into video.
The shots, I mean, you are the faces of these incredible artists with all of their history etched into those faces fills the screen. Any sense of ever cutting away from their faces?
Yeah, well, you get caught up in that music and you sort of it's like you're going into a music hall in that camera, you know, and you don't want to come out.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your journey through soul music with us.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
D.A. Penny Baker and Chris Hegedus directed the new film Only the Strong Survive.
Only the strong survive. Only the strong survive.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
With your head hung down, so I wouldn't let the little girl know and let her know. She made me feel like a clown. I say a whole lot of girls,
whole lot of girls,
looking for a good man like you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.